and welcome to the world of Grape Encounters Radio. We're so glad that you could join us here today. I'm your host, David Wilson. And you know, on Grape Encounters, we normally bring you the people, the places, and the products that make drinking wine so doggone much fun. But on today's show, we're going to go in a very different direction as we explore the topic of romance and wine. Yes, romance and wine. Later on in the show, we're going to have a fellow on by the name of Clive Pursehouse, and he is a writer for the Oregon Wine Blog. Now, how we came to know Clive was through an episode that we did some weeks ago with the Seattle Wine Gal. Now, on that episode, we got on the subject of screw cap enclosures for wine, and I made some rather derogatory comments about screw caps only from the perspective that I thought they took a lot away from the romantic experience of wine drinking. Well, we got a lot of correspondence about that show, and Clive was the leader of the pack, protesting my comments and exclaiming that both Oregon and Washington wines were so doggone good that the screw cap enclosure made little difference when it came to the romance of the wine because the wines could stand on their own two feet. Clive arranged to have some wines sent to us. We have them here today. We're going to try them a little later on in the show, and we're going to see if, in fact, the quality of those Oregon and Washington wines is so extraordinary that it'll overcome the enclosure. But first, do we have a guest for you? She is the co-author of the Love Diet Cookbook, which is filled with simple recipes for a healthier, happier, sexier you. Do the foods we eat and the wines we drink really have aphrodisiac qualities? We're going to find out in this first segment as we bring you Amy Riley. She is a food and wine expert known worldwide as an authority on the aphrodisiac qualities of what we consume. And we are so happy, Amy, to have you on the show today. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the Love Diet has just come out, and this is an amazing topic. In fact, I guess you've been doing this for quite a number of years now, but as far as I can see, you're the leading authority on the aphrodisiac qualities of food and wine.
I mean, you know, that's what they say. I kind of think, oh, I'm probably the only person doing it. But yeah, no, this has been a topic that has been of interest to me for quite a long time. I've been writing on it for probably 8 years, and my first book, Fork Me, Spoon Me, came out 4 years ago.
So what inspired you to do this to begin with? Or is that a personal question?
Yes, I enjoy the field work. No. I was working as a wine journalist, and I was quite young. And being young and female and a wine journalist often doesn't really fly, unfortunately. I had some really
I think that's changing, though, now.
Oh, it is. It is changing, definitely. It was, you know, I'd like to think I was a pioneer. Well, who knows? But I needed to diversify, and I was trying to think about what really interested me, and I love Greek mythology, and I love the nutrition side of food.
Right.
Obviously, I wanted to stay in the food and wine realm, and it just seemed like a natural fit for me, although I have to say, when I started out, it was difficult finding information from a culinary perspective. There was, you know, some scientific research, and there's a lot of anthropological study, but there really wasn't a lot of information on food.
Before we had all of these enhancement drugs, haven't people, since the beginning of time, been using food as an aphrodisiac?
Absolutely. And, you know, when people ask me, well, do they work, I like to point out that not only have people been, you know, have these aphrodisiacs stood the test of time, but also keep in mind that up until modern times, most cultures were actually starving. So I don't think they'd be labeling food for some kind of medicinal use and sharing them and treating people with them if there wasn't some sort of validity, if they didn't see some sort of result, because all in all, they really just didn't have enough food as it was.
But I think it's really true, isn't it, that if you serve a meal to somebody, depending upon what you're serving, that meal can make your guests lethargic, it can make them energetic. I mean, food really does control our moods in a big way.
It really does.
So how do you figure out, first of all, well, how do we determine if a food does have an aphrodisiac quality? Is there some sort of test that you do to the food, or is it just trial and error? How do we determine this?
Well, I mean, we, you know, by now we know because people have been talking about them since before recorded time. So we have a pretty good grasp if you look at it historically. And, of course, there's in modern times some scientific study to support it. But like any kind of medication or any kind of exercise regime or anything else, it's very individual. What works well for you may not work for someone else. For example, Pinot Noir might be the ultimate for you, but I know people who absolutely can't stand red wine. So, right. You know what I mean?
So let's talk about wine for a second. Obviously, wine has alcohol in it, and alcohol will help to make for a more relaxed mood. No question about that. But where does the aphrodisiac quality come in?
Well, the ability to let down your guard, that whole, and it enhances mood as well a little bit. Those qualities are considered aphrodisiac attributes of wine. But in addition, some wines have aromatics that replicate human pheromones. And so even the mere scent of wine sometimes can be a turn-on.
Okay, if you're just joining us, we have Amy Riley on, who's the co-author of The Love Diet. We're talking about foods and wines that have aphrodisiac qualities. So in wine, you say there are aromatics. Can you speak specifically to certain types of wine? Because I know people are going to rush out and buy these as soon as you list them.
Absolutely. One that often surprises people is those petrally Rieslings, those dry Rieslings, especially aged ones, usually the German ones, that have that quite petrally quality. Petrol and white pepper, that actually has a female pheromone, as do yeasty, cheesy sorts of champagnes.
Okay.
Very, very successful at replicating a female pheromone. And the interesting thing about that is that not only will it help to get a man in the mood, but some studies have shown that we kind of like our own scent as well. And so it can actually, that can also work to kind of arouse a woman to smell those lovely, bready, yeasty aromas. And that's why I think that a lot of men are so drawn, especially American men, are really drawn to those masculine scented cabs. I think it's just narcissism.
Really? So in an encounter, how does that work? If you're sitting down with somebody and you're drinking a great big gutsy cab, how's that going to affect that whole situation?
So if you say we're serving a romantic meal to a woman and you served her this very masculine, earthy Cabernet,
right.
Those aromas would start subconsciously to kind of get her in the mood.
Really?
As well as you.
A big cab. And is that is that across the board?
I mean, not necessarily like a big, ripe cab, but ones that have more earthy, leathery, sweaty, those big, you know, very masculine sorts.
Are there some that you can particularly point to?
Two reds actually jump to mind, but they aren't specifically cabs. Two actually Napa Valley reds.
Okay.
That I had recently, and one is the Dariush, which is a red blend, and then the other is Swanson's Alexis, which is a Syrah-based blend.
Now you have a list on your website, certainly of aphrodisiac foods.
Yeah.
And you've got sort of the A to Z of those, and I want to get into those in the next segment, but you also have, I noticed, I think it was your Valentine's Day list of wines that you recommend 10 wines on your website that will put people in the mood.
I did do that, and it seems so long ago now, I can't recall what they were, to be quite honest, but that's a good list.
Well, the list is on your website.
GoEatSomethingSexy.com.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the website. It's EatSomethingSexy.com. And there's a ton of stuff on there. You can learn a lot on this site. But it does have, if you search around a little bit, it has the top 10 Valentine wines, and then you list them all. And they're all pretty readily available. But the list of foods is really interesting, too. But we're going to come right back with Amy Riley. Just stick with us for just a second, and we will return after this break. Oh my gosh, folks, there are so many events coming up, too many to talk about, but there are three that I think you absolutely have to put on your bucket list. They get the Grape Encounter seal of approval. First of all, of course, we've been talking about Fiddle Fest, and Fiddle Fest is June 19th. and you are going to experience the wines of 14 superstar winemakers. We've been talking about it on today's show, but you can go to fiddleheadcellars.com/events, and you can buy tickets. The pre-sale cost is $72.80, or you can pay $85 at the door. There's going to be mouth-watering food from Hitching Post Barbecue, local musical favorites. You can kick up your heels. It is going to be so much fun. It's going to be at the Fiddlesticks Vineyard, of course, at mile marker 7.28. Grape Encounters Radio is pleased to be a sponsor of the Chardonnay Symposium, brought to you by the Santa Maria Valley Wine Country. The Chardonnay Symposium will be taking place on Saturday, July 31st, 2010, and it will occur at a number of different locations. The symposium will be the first event of its kind dedicated to the country's most popular varietal, Chardonnay. In 2009, the Nielsen Company reported that Chardonnay was by far the top-selling varietal, and according to Western Farm Press in 2006, Chardonnay was the largest acreage wine grape with almost 95,000 acres. If you want more information on the Chardonnay Symposium, you can go to, oh, what a coincidence, thechardonnaysymposium.com. Again, it's the Chardonnay Symposium, taking place Saturday, July 31st, and brought to you by the Santa Maria Valley Wine Country. And then a third thing that I want to tell you about, it's out of the area. You have to travel a little bit up into the mountains, but this has been going on for many years now. If you really want to get away and you want to try all kinds of incredible wines in one of the most idyllic settings that you could possibly imagine, then why not check out the Lake Arrowhead Rotary Art and Wine Festival? This is a truly fun event. It takes place June 26th and 27th in beautiful Lake Arrowhead. It goes on from 10 a.m. till 7 p.m. on Saturday and 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. And it's in a place called Tavern Bay. And Tavern Bay is an extraordinarily beautiful place. You'll see incredible art there, just booth after booth after booth, and lots of incredible wines to taste. This is the Lake Arrowhead Rotary Art and Wine Festival. For more information, go to lakearrowheadrotary.net. Back with more Grape Encounters. It's David Wilson here with my guest, Amy Riley, who is the co-author of The Love Diet. And we are talking about Grape Encounters of a very different kind today. We're talking about the effect of wine on a romantic encounter and if certain wines actually have aphrodisiac qualities. And we're going to talk both about food and wine. I guess, Amy, what I want to ask you is this. So I'm a single guy and I'm having somebody over for dinner and I want it to be a little bit more romantic, or I in some way want to enhance the romance of that evening. What do I serve? What do I cook? And what kind of wines do I serve?
All right. Well,
what's the perfect date? What do I do?
The first thing you're going to do is set yourself up for success.
Okay.
And the way that I recommend doing that is to select foods that can be prepared ahead of time, or things that are going to sit in the oven and bake and do the work themselves instead of you slaving over the stovetop, because you want to save your energy for other activities.
So you're saying that I shouldn't really be doing the cooking in front of her. I should have everything in the oven or on the stove. But now, am I going to find some potential recipes in the Love Diet cookbook?
You're going to find a lot of potential recipes in the Love Diet cookbook. And actually, what's really going to help you is the next thing that I was going to talk about, which is that you want to then choose. There are some ingredients that you can choose that have an immediate aphrodisiac effect. And in fact, in the Love Diet, there is an entire chapter dedicated to what we call the little blue pill foods. And the kind of foods I'm talking about are things like coffee, which great way to end the meal with an espresso, because coffee not only will give you that stimulation, that little burst of energy right at the right time, because otherwise after the meal, you know, your energy is busy digesting. But coffee is also a mood enhancer.
Okay, so this is so contrary to what I think most people think, because most people are going to say after the meal, we're going to do an after dinner drink, right? And you're saying go for the espresso.
Absolutely. Although, you know what is delicious together is to serve both an espresso and a nice port.
Okay.
Sort of the very sweet and the very bitter, and they both have acidity, so they complement each other quite nicely. So that's one lovely idea.
And I noticed you mentioned port a number of times on the website. It comes up often. So what is it about port?
You know, I have never read any specific study about port being particularly aphrodisiac, any more so than your average wine. However, on my trip to Portugal, everyone in the wine business swore to me that port is their one and only choice of aphrodisiac, and that during the harvest time, the whole Douro Valley kind of turns very lustful. And I've heard some crazy tales of things that have gone on in the vineyard that had nothing to do with picking grapes. And I don't get these stories when I visit other wine countries, so I'm pretty much sold on port.
Can I go back to that cab for a second? Because that's starting to sink in. We were talking about manly, leathery cabs. And
yep.
Is it the same thing as when a man wears a cologne that's sort of musky and manly? Is it the same effect?
I don't know for sure. I've never really studied perfumes and colognes. I personally can't stand them because they detract from the aromas of wine and food and, you know, in nature. So it's not something that I've really gotten into. I'm sure the information is out there. And I have read studies of people applying pheromones to topically and that it does instantly attract other people. So I'm quite sure that these things work, but I can't tell you any specifics.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. I was in a wine tasting room recently, and for whatever reason, they decided that they were going to sell scented candles there too. And
no.
I'm telling you, it was, I didn't even want to taste the wine because the candles were such a turnoff. And now I'm getting the idea that when I have somebody over for a romantic dinner, that I shouldn't light scented candles and I should let the food and the wine be the aroma in the room. Is that what we're saying?
The food, the wine, and also, you know, it sounds kind of dirty, but your personal scent.
Okay.
It's part of the chemistry. And the more that you mask those things, the less you have the ability to have that chemistry connection. So, yeah, I would avoid the scented candles. I would avoid the cologne. They're really not necessary. If there's a spark of chemistry between you, it's better to let that naturally, you know, kind of ride out.
I got a bunch of guys out there that are shaking their head right now that spent, you know, $80 on a bottle of Gucci that are going there. And so that's so contrary to what we all believe. You're better off to splash on a little Cabernet on your neck, I think, probably.
Absolutely.
You'd be better off.
Or one thing I tell women is there was a study on the scent of vanilla, and it was shown to be successful in arousing older gentlemen. So if you're looking for a sugar daddy, just reach into the cabinet and dab some vanilla on.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so let's talk about food again.
Give me a
meal plan for this ultimate romantic date out of the love diet. What's tried and true and is going to be one of the best options that I can choose?
Well, one of my favorite, I think, home run dishes is a stovetop sous vide salmon.
Okay.
With a fennel and apricot slaw. Now, there are a multitude of reasons why I think this one's going to work. First of all, the slaw can be made ahead of time, so great, that's off your plate. And fennel has natural plant
essence,
a lovely aphrodisiac. And plus, it's, you know, got this lovely light flavor. The dried apricot's also wonderful because dried apricots are loaded with iron and with fiber. Both are things that we need to maintain a healthy libido. So you have your wonderful slaw made. It's in the refrigerator waiting. Then you're going to do a stovetop variation on sous vide. And sous vide, of course, is the slow poaching method that is very hot in the whole molecular gastronomy crowd. So you're going to look really cool because you've adapted this to do it at home.
Okay.
And, of course, once it's all prepped, all you have to do is let it slowly poach in a pot of water. And the only things you're going to do are keep a thermometer in it and keep the temperature at a certain level by throwing in ice cubes if you have to.
So how long is it actually going to be on the stove?
About 18 minutes.
Okay.
Depending on the piece of fish.
So right, I have everything ready on the stove, and she gets there and maybe we have a glass of wine, but then at some point 18 minutes before the meal I go over and casually drop this in. I look cool. And then what am I doing?
Well, then you're, you know, occasionally checking and dropping an ice cube in, or you can drop one down her back or whatever, you know, whatever works for you while it's cooking. But once it's finished, you just assemble it. You put the slaw on the plate. You put your fish on top. And then you top it with a little bit of salmon roe. Serve it with a bottle of Tandem Winery's San Giacomo Chardonnay, which has all of those sweaty, feral, wild, feminine, pheromonal characteristics, And I swear the whole thing is just a done deal.
And that's it, just the Chardonnay for the evening. And we'll have the port with the espresso for dessert, right?
Exactly. Have a port and espresso, maybe a little bit of chocolate. You know, just buy a bar of really great chocolate, like Lindt 70% cocoa. Oh, it's a great chocolate bar.
We have Amy Riley on, co-author of The Love Diet, and an authority on aphrodisiac qualities in food and wine. Where do you find the book?
You can find the book at lovedietcookbook.com.
And how are sales going on the book? Are people just going mad for this? Because there's nothing like it, right?
We actually had an enormous number of pre-sales. I was really excited. So I'm looking forward to the future. You know, it's just come out, but I'm really, really excited about the potential.
So tell me, how do I use the book? Will it explain to me the strategies as well that you talked about, like the ideas of texture and not over perfuming and, you know, all of this?
Absolutely. Well, the book is divided up with 5 recipe chapters that each have a different kind of focus, depending what your love diet goal is. And you can go in between chapters. As I mentioned before, there's the little blue pill chapter, which is where what you might want to focus on to plan that romantic dinner. There is the romantic weekend chapter, when you just want the whole world to go away and it's the two of you for a weekend or a day. There's also a chapter of reduced calorie foods if you want to be on the love diet and not only have a better libido, but lose a little weight.
I want to go back to your website for a second, because your website has this very extensive list of foods that purportedly have aphrodisiac qualities. And again, the website is eatsomethingsexy.com, right?
That's it.
Okay, so we have a couple more minutes. Let's talk about a couple more really powerful aphrodisiac food and wines.
All right. Well, a food that's just coming into season that's a great aphrodisiac is watermelon.
Watermelon. Yeah, and there was a lot of talk about this recently, and that's true, huh?
Yep. Watermelon has citrulline, and citrulline is a phytonutrient that has the power to act like nature's Viagra.
Wow.
They say you need about 6 cups of watermelon in one sitting to get any of that Viagra-like benefit, but heck, 6 cups isn't that much, right?
No, it doesn't seem like it. Okay, what else?
We've talked about cheeses because of their aromas and the PEA, so cheese is a great choice. Now, of course, if you're going on the love diet, you want to, you know, have your cheese in moderation. I actually hate the word moderation.
Gosh, this is so much information. So I buy the Love Diet online.
The book has its own website
if
you want to find out more information about it, and that's lovedietcookbook.com.
And then on eatsomethingsexy.com, I can also subscribe to your newsletter, right?
You can. It's the Aphrodisiac of the Month newsletter.
Okay, and what am I going to find in that?
So every month you'll get some information on an ingredient that's an aphrodisiac. This month, for example, it was basil. Sometimes you'll get a recipe. You'll always get some ideas of what you might want to do with it. Just simple, easy, and you'll also get some updates on what's new on eatsomethingsexy.com. We always have new wine recommendations going up and sometimes some new aphrodisiac information. We actually have about 7 or 8 professional journalists who contribute to the site, so there's always something new.
Okay, now, because our show is for wine lovers, where will we find tips about wine?
Well, on eatsomethingsexy.com, there's a whole wine section. So we've got information on particular wineries. Every month, I write a column called Woman on Wine, which recommends some things that I want to be drinking right now. And there's some other feature stories online as well.
So it's eatsomethingsexy.com, and you can subscribe to the newsletter there. You can find, really, folks, there's a ton of information on that website. And one of the really interesting things is Amy has a list of all of these aphrodisiac foods, and you can click on it, and then it gives you more information about these individual foods. I had no idea about basil, by the way. And it's the number one ingredient that I use.
Perfect. Well, you must be doing well.
Well, I'm still single, Amy. So anyway, okay, we've been talking to Amy Riley, co-author of The Love Diet, and gosh, it's been so interesting talking to you. I appreciate it so much. We're going to put a link up on grapeencountersradio.com to your website so people can find this information and have a much better love life and really, truly improve their grape encounters. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. We'll be back with more Grape Encounters in just a second. David Wilson here, and I want to remind you to visit Grape Encounters Radio, where you will find a wealth of information about things going on in the world of Grape Encounters. You'll also find information about some of the events that we highly recommend that you attend, and that includes the Cellar Classic, which is coming up on August 1st, 2010 in Los Olivos at St. Mark's Episcopal Church. It's a rare and fine wine auction, and we will have Stephen Pepe of Clopepe Vineyards and his friend Brooks Firestone, who was the first person to make wine in the Santa Ynez Valley. And anyway, they're going to talk all about this incredible event, which is going to feature some wines that will absolutely blow your mind, wines that have been in cellars for decades. And anyway, we'll have more information about the Cellar Classic as we get closer to it. Another event that we, of course, have been talking about is Fiddle Fest, which is returning on June 19th. And that will take place at the Fiddlesticks Vineyard on Santa Rosa Road at mile marker 7.28. There'll be 14 superstar winemakers there, all winemakers who buy their grapes from the folks at Fiddlehead Cellars. So anyway, this is going to be a great time, which includes great entertainment. Yes, there will be fiddling there and mouth-watering hitching post barbecue food. It's going to be a great time. So go there and kick up your heels. For more information, you can go to fiddleheadcellars.com/events. That's fiddleheadcellars.com. Presale tickets are, in celebration of the mile marker, $72.80. And then another event out of the wine country, but in a very, very beautiful setting, is the Lake Arrowhead Rotary Art and Wine Festival, June 26th and 27th. Why not make it a weekend up in beautiful Lake Arrowhead? On Saturday, the event runs from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., and on Sunday, it's 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. at the beautiful, and I mean beautiful, Tavern Bay Beach Club. There's going to be over 80 artists and vendors there, and admission includes a souvenir wine glass and boat shuttle from Lake Arrowhead Village to the Tavern Bay Beach Club. There is a VIP wine tasting patio, and of course you can taste wine all over the grounds. So for more information, go to lakearrowheadrotary.net. That's lakearrowheadrotary.net. I cannot tell you how long I have waited to do this segment. It's a case of not being able to leave well enough alone. I don't know if you guys remember, but back on the 18th of April, we did a show and we had the Seattle Wine Gal on. And somewhere in the conversation, we started talking about boxed wines and screw cap wines. And I made a comment about the fact that I thought that screw cap wines really ruined the romance of wine. I set off a little firestorm when I did that. I got an email from the guest that we have on the phone right now. It's Clive Pursehouse. And Clive sent me an email, I think it was the next day, protesting my comments about, I think, Clive, you thought I was belittling screw caps, right?
Yeah, maybe dismissing is a better word.
Dismissing it. Now, Clive, let's understand who Clive is, first of all. He writes for the Oregon Wine Blog, which, by the way, is a terrific blog. You can check it out at OregonWineBlog.com. And you guys have some interesting philosophies over there, and maybe you can share them with our listeners.
Yeah, so the Oregon Wine Blog is a kind of, our philosophy is to make wine approachable, kind of provide a accessible platform for people who are in their 20s and 30s to learn about wine and, quite frankly, to be introduced to some excellent Northwestern wine specifically. We believe that wine journalism, by and large, is pretty dull. You know, how many times do you want to read wine descriptions about dark fruit notes and toasted vanilla? So we talk about experiences instead. And, you know, we really enjoyed this wine. We visited with the winemaker. He or she was really interesting or funny. We were impressed with the tasting room staff, that sort of thing.
But that's exactly what we do on Grape Encounters. I mean, and actually, you kind of insinuated that I was a California wine snob. I hope we've cleared that up since then.
Yeah, we clearly, I do that, and I apologize. But that's true. I did make that insinuation.
Okay, so but I want to read this part of your remark that was made in, because it was interesting. You said, to your remark about romance being 90% of the wine experience, I have to disagree and wonder what you're drinking and why it's letting you down so horribly. And I said, can you clarify that comment, Clive?
Well, I guess I believe that it's the quality of the wine, and it's in the glass. If you want to call it romance, I think it's romance happens in the glass. And when I put my nose to a glass of Oregon Pinot Noir or maybe a Washington Syrah or one of the wines we're going to be drinking in a few minutes, a Washington Cabernet, I mean, that is where the real beauty of the wine experience comes from for me. And it's not so much the cork removal or the ritual where the wait staff place the cork down in front of me at the table. It's really that the romance and the beauty of the wine happens in the glass.
Well, you know, I don't know if you listened to the show that we did the next week, but we were so inspired by your comments that I hunted down a piece of research that was done by a company called the Tragon Corporation, and they're in Redwood City, albeit I know California, but they're a consumer behavior research firm. And we interviewed Becky Bleibaum, and this study that they did, are you familiar with it?
I'm not sure. I have to hear the content.
Okay, well, you got to check it out. Okay, here's the study. They studied people's perception of corks versus synthetic corks versus screw caps in the United States, France, Britain, and Australia. And overwhelmingly, if you look at the study, and it was a big study too, the people in the United States and France, that's the one thing we agree on, really have an aversion to screw caps and somewhat of an aversion to synthetic corks, but not like the aversion to screw caps. In Britain and in Australia, there's almost no aversion whatsoever. And I think probably if they did that study and they studied older people and younger people like you're trying to speak to at the Oregon Wine Blog, that there would probably be a big difference in attitude, I think.
I think that's probably true. The other thing I think, I don't know if you've ever read the book To Cork or Not to Cork. Great book, very easy read, pretty short. But the history of cork usage and international trade is that Australia and New Zealand and the New World, by and large, got the worst cork from, you know, many, many years now this has been going on. And so Australia and New Zealand decided, why are we getting so much poor product? We've got to do something about this. And that's where a lot of the screw cap kind of industry was birthed, was down there. I'm not a screw cap zealot, and so I want to put that out there that I'm not a anti-cork screw cap zealot. The bone that I had to pick with you was the idea, and maybe I'm embellishing a bit, but
it's okay.
The dismissal of screw cap wine as cheap swill is what I'm out to counter, and I was at an event called Taste Washington, and several hundred Washington wineries were there, and I was talking to a young guy who's a winemaker named Mike. He makes a wine called 8-Bit Vintners, and he makes one blend. It's in a screw cap. It's always been in a screw cap. And this person, at the end of the event, asked him for his corks. They wanted to make a trivet, or I don't know what they were doing, but he said, oh, I've been in screw cap all the time. And he goes, this guy, this cork collector, said, well, that's not real wine, is it? And he walked away, and I was just astonished, and he's like, I get that all the time.
And no, I was just going to say, if you're just joining us, we have on the line Clive Pursehouse, who writes for the Oregon Wine Blog, and it's To Screw Cap or Not to Screw Cap. Well, why couldn't you guys just put a blog out on how to make trivets out of screw caps?
We might do that.
That would solve the problem. But so listen, so here's what happened. I want to bring the listeners forward just a little bit. So Clive decided that it would only be fair for us to try a couple of wines from Oregon and Washington and see if, in fact, the quality of the wine is so compelling that we just forget about the screw cap, right?
More or less. I there's wine, these two wines that we're going to drink, these people know what they're doing. If I could just say a little bit about Argyle Winery, their winemaker, Roland Soles, he's been making wine for more than 20 years. And he has been involved in a lot of research around closures. And as someone who, 11 times has made it into the top 100 wines of the world, he's not messing around.
Okay, so here's his tasting notes, okay? He says, this is our classic big furniture Pinot Noir style delivered from Lone Star Vineyards. Its melanite color is the first indication of its boldness. The aroma is black cherry reduction fruit, black licorice, Earl Grey spices, and that luscious, fresh, earthy quality that says nut house. I'm not sure what that means. But anyway, the flavors are big, juicy black cherry and black plum pudding spices. The texture forms a rich, creamy center to this richly ripe Pinot Noir. The ripe plum and cherry fruit carry on and on. It is a wonderful thing to experience such powerful exotic Pinot Noir, yet wonder at its bright balance, mineral pinpoint, touch twirling on the palate. Wow. Like, I cannot wait to taste this wine.
I'm telling you.
Tom, what do you think about that? I mean, the idea.
I can't wait to taste this wine. That sounds great.
Okay, so that voice that you hear is my dear friend Tom Bachman, who is a winemaker of 40 years, but just a home winemaker, right?
That's right.
But you know your wines. You've probably spent $1 million on wine in your life.
Of other people's money on my expense account. And that's what got me onto wine drinking.
And so I dragged Tom in here this afternoon because I really wanted to get a second opinion, because he's the most honest guy I know as far as wine, and the only guy that drinks more wine than I do. So are you looking forward to this?
You bet.
Okay, so the Argyle is the first one that we're going to taste, and then the second one is the Dusted Valley Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yeah, Dusted Valley out of Walla Walla. It's two brothers-in-law, Chad and Corey, and they've not been making wine that long, but they moved to Screw Cap after their first vintage. Chad Johnson, one of the winemakers, he has a food quality background. And so the decision to move to Screw Cap was protect their investment. It's an investment of money. It's an investment of time. Protect their reputation. They know that their product is going to maintain its quality under a Screw Cap. They're not worried about cork taint. They're not worried about oxidation. They're not worried about uneven aging. So
okay, these guys at Dusted Valley were named the 2010 Washington Winery of the Year, were they not, from the Wine Press of the Northwest?
That's correct. And wow. They've not been doing it very long. They have a lot of fun with it. They've got a really cool wine club called the Stained Tooth Society. They send you a toothbrush.
They did. They sent me a toothbrush with the wine. But I got to stop you right there because we've got the wine open. We've got to take a really quick break here. We're going to come back. And when we come back, we will have poured the glasses and we will be ready with glasses and microphones in hand when we return to Grape Encounters Radio. Can you hang with us? Oh my gosh, folks, there are so many events coming up, too many to talk about, but there are three that I think you absolutely have to put on your bucket list. They get the Grape Encounter seal of approval. First of all, of course, we've been talking about Fiddlefest, and Fiddlefest is June 19th, and you are going to experience the wines of 14 superstar winemakers. We've been talking about it on today's show, but you can go to fiddleheadcellars.com/events, and you can buy tickets. The pre-sale cost is $72.80, or you can pay $85 at the door. There's going to be mouth-watering food from Hitching Post Barbecue, local musical favorites. You can kick up your heels. It is going to be so much fun. It's going to be at the Fiddlesticks Vineyard, of course, at mile marker 7.28. Now, another event we're going to be talking a lot more about is the Cellar Classic. It is the first rare wine sale and auction to take place in the Santa Ynez Valley. It's going to take place at St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Los Olivos, and they're calling it the St. Mark's Episcopal Church Rare and Fine Wine Auction. Now, this is going to go on August 1st, 2010, as I said, in Los Olivos. And in a couple of weeks, we're going to have the one and only Brooks Firestone, who was the first person to make wine in the Valley, along with legendary Pinot maker Stephen Pepe. And we're going to talk all about the Cellar Classic, and they're going to give you a rundown on some of these incredible incredibly rare wines that are going to be available at that event. So it's the Cellar Classic, and we're going to post more information about that on our website, grapeencountersradio.com. And then a third thing that I want to tell you about. It's out of the area. You have to travel a little bit up into the mountains, but this has been going on for many years now. If you really want to get away and you want to try all kinds of incredible wines in one of the most idyllic settings that you could possibly imagine, then why not check out the Lake Arrowhead Rotary Art and Wine Festival? This is a truly, truly fun event. It takes place June 26th and 27th in beautiful Lake Arrowhead. It goes on from 10 a.m. till 7 p.m. on Saturday and 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. And it's in a place called Tavern Bay. And Tavern Bay is an extraordinarily beautiful place. You'll see incredible art there, just booth after booth after booth, and lots of incredible wines to taste. This is the Lake Arrowhead Rotary Art and Wine Festival. For more information, go to lakearrowheadrotary.net. And we are back with Grape Encounters Radio, and it's time for the fun part because we have our glasses poured. It's a 2006 Nuthouse Pinot Noir from Argyle in the Willamette Valley. And we've got on the line Clive Pursehouse, who writes for the Oregon Wine Blog. And he had these wines sent to us, the Argyle and a Dusted Valley Cabernet Sauvignon, just to prove the point that wines can be so good that they're romantic even if we have to deal with a screw cap enclosure. So we're about to put that to the test. And I've got in the studio Tom Bachman, a 40-year home winemaker, a real wine lover and aficionado. You're on your way up to Oregon to do some wine tasting.
Yes, the Rogue Valley.
Do you have it there as well, Clive?
I do. I have a bottle of each.
Oh, my gosh. This is virtual wine tasting. So Tom's sniffing. I'm sniffing. I can't talk and sniff at the same time. I just learned. Okay, I got to admit, the first impression is a strong first impression. Tom's got a big smile on his face. What are you thinking?
I'm loving it. It's very nice.
He says he's loving it. And Clive, you're familiar with this wine, right?
I'm familiar with this wine. I'm familiar with this winery. These guys make world-class Pinot Noir. They make sparkling. They make a Chardonnay as well. The winemaker, he's a Texan. He's kind of a wild guy and an institution in the Willamette Valley. He's been a pioneer in Oregon winemaking. And for my money, and no offense to California or France, but if you're going to give me a Pinot, I want it to be from Oregon.
Okay, so now you said something that's interesting because there was another part, and I don't think I can dig it out and talk at the same time, but there was another exchange that you and I had by email because I was talking to you about a Texas winemaker, and you were pretty critical of the whole idea of Texas wines, but now we're finding out that the winemaker at Argyle is actually a Texan. You got some splaining to do here.
You know, I lived in Texas for a little while.
So oh, yeah. There's more truth coming out.
Yeah, I am a bit suspicious about wines from certain places, and maybe that's hypocritical. Maybe that's I should look into that. I will say this: I had a bubbly from New Mexico, and I was impressed. And so, I'm certainly willing to give anything a try. The reason I brought it up is he's rough and tumble kind of Texan guy. That's why I brought it up.
A little suspicious of Texas winemakers, but once you get to Oregon, you catch on pretty fast.
Well, you've got such great terroir, and the fruit and everything in Oregon just sets up perfectly for Pinot. So,
okay, so we talk a lot about the Pinots that are made in the Santa Rita Hills here in California, and I just wonder, do you try those? Do you drink those?
I had one Sunday. I liked it quite a bit.
Okay, now, I mean, I have to admit, I think this is a pretty big Pinot compared to a lot of the California Pinots I drink. Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's got some real oomph to it. This is not a wimpy wine, not at all. How do you like your Pinots, Clive?
I like a big Pinot. I like an earthy, kind of nutty notes that I get out of the Oregon Pinots. I feel like I'm not an expert. I'm not a sommelier or anything like that. But if you gave me five Pinots, I could tell you which one was from Oregon. I feel fairly confident about that.
But you see a thread where there's a real commonality between all the Oregon Pinots.
So are the Oregon? Do the Oregon Pinots have common characteristics?
I feel like that earthy character that you get is very common to Oregon, and I can pick it out of a crowd, certainly.
Okay, so here's what I think we should probably do now. I think we should take this one step further. I thought we were going to end it here, but I don't think we are. Or maybe we just need to all get together and do a serious blind tasting and do a little challenge, you know, Oregon and Washington versus California, whichever state you pick.
I'd be happy to do that.
Really? Okay. Because I think it would just be fun to see if you could actually, if we could like lay 10 wines out there and five of them are from your region and five of them are from California or wherever, and see if you could actually pick the five. And then we could have a really big prize for you.
All right.
Okay, sounds good. All right, let's move on to the next wine. The next wine is the Dusted Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. It's a 2006, and I'm pretty excited about this wine. This wine has gotten really decent reviews, and I can tell you I'm not real familiar with too many Washington cabs. So what can you tell us about this?
I have had this wine, and it's been a while since I've had it. I think that Cabernets out of Washington have probably gotten less publicity than, you know, everybody knows about the Syrah that we make up here and how intense that is and how delicious it is. This wine, I think, is going to speak for itself as well.
Okay, well, we've been tasting it here. Tom is studying this wine very carefully. I've seen him shake his head, but I don't know really what the head shake means. Tom, your opinion of this Dusted Valley Cabernet Sauvignon?
Well, I am enjoying it too. I prefer the bigger, I would say, fruitier.
That's what I would say. I prefer a bigger cab, yeah.
Kind of California wines, but Cabernets. But this is very nice. I think the flavors are really subtle, and it would be just a delight to have with dinner.
I think this is a beautiful wine. It's a very soft, gentle cab compared to most California Cabernets, which some people describe as over the top. But it's interesting because are you principally a Pinot drinker?
No, I like everything.
Okay.
Truly, I enjoy all wine. There's not a wine I'll turn my nose up to. And I think Tom's point, not as in your face, but there's so much going on in this glass. It's just phenomenal.
But there's an interesting thing that I've noticed between these two wines. This Pinot definitely takes Pinot up a notch, and this Cab, I think, steps down a notch in terms of intensity. I'm not talking about the quality or the flavor of the wine. The wine's really good, but it's a lot softer than most Cabs. The Pinot is a lot bigger than what I'm used to drinking, so they're kind of meeting in the middle to some degree. And Tom, you had a comment about this.
Well, I think you're right as usual, David.
Right as usual. But here's the big question, guys, okay? And I guess it's the question to us. Are we willing to concede that the wine is solid enough to retain the romantic quality of the wine and have a screw cap top?
Well, my point is that was your point, and I've never been put off by screw caps.
You've never been put off by screw caps. Okay, well, that's fair enough.
Yeah, you know, I think a couple things. One thing that I'll point out, and I got some research today, that in 2003, synthetic corks and screw caps were only used in approximately 8% of wines worldwide. And in today's U.S. Market, it's approaching 40%. So that's one thing. So I think you can look at that from a variety of different angles on value wines versus fine wines and who's using screw caps. And as I said earlier, you know, I am not a screw cap zealot by any stretch of the imagination. But what I think people need to realize, consumers, people like you, people like me, is that winemakers use screw caps for a reason. And there's a lot of science behind the reasoning that they're using these screw caps for. And I would point you to a Wine Spectator article from March 9th, 2010, and they did a research project with 14 different closures over 10 years, and screw caps came out looking the best from an aging perspective and a consistency perspective and so on and so forth.
All right. I absolutely accept that conclusion. I just think that we're going to have to find more romantic ways to unscrew these wines when we're out on a romantic date. That's, I guess, what we're going to have to come up with some new rituals. Clive, before we go, I wanted to ask you about bicycling because you're a professional cyclist, right?
I'm a rank amateur when it comes to racing.
Okay.
But I enjoy it, and if I could be a professional anything, I would be a professional cyclist. Yeah. I race both cyclocross and road racing here in the Northwest in Washington predominantly. I'm not as strong on the road race circuit as I am in the cyclocross circuit, but I'm a beginner at both, and I love cycling, and I think there are ways to marry wine and cycling. And my
I totally agree with you. And have you ever noticed that it doesn't matter what wine region you go to? It doesn't matter if you go to the Napa Valley, you go to Washington, you go to the Central Coast, you go to the Loire Valley in France. Any wine region you go to, you're going to find cyclists, period. All right. Well, listen, if you want more insight into Northwestern wines, you can go to the OregonWineBlog.com, and you can check out stories by, we're going to call you our friend, Clive.
There you go.
Our friend Clive Pursehouse. He writes a really good column for the Oregon Wine Blog, and actually, it's a really fun wine blog to read, so check it out. I'm going to officially concede that these wines that you've sent to us are good enough to really appreciate regardless of the screw cap, and I think we can integrate them into a romantic situation, although reluctantly, I'm going to say. And I would far prefer a cork, but I am not going to thumb my nose at these Oregon and Washington wines. They're really excellent, and I can give them our recommendation. It's the Dusted Valley 2006 Cabernet Sauvignon, and it's the Argyle 2006 Nuthouse Pinot Noir, right?
That's right. And David, I want to thank you for being willing to entertain the idea that not only are we making phenomenal wines here in the Northwest, but we're making some of them under screw cap, and they're damn good. If I don't know if I can say that on the air. Do I have to?
Yeah, I think that's fine.
Okay.
Okay, but we're not done with you, Clive, because we're gonna come back to you with a challenge.
I'll take your challenge, and hopefully I'm going to have to drink some wine in between now and then and just make sure my chops are ready. But I would be happy to come back on in some capacity and go through that exercise.
All right. Well, I'm gonna come up with a prize. I'm going to see if one of our California Pinot makers will ante up a case of Pinot. How's that?
Pretty good prize.
And if you can get all of your, let's say all five of your wines, you can guess them, then you win the case. Fair enough?
That's fair. And I just have to guess where they're from.
You just have to say that they're Washington or Oregon. How's that?
Okay, that's fair.
All right, it's been fun. We've had on Clive Pursehouse. He writes for the Oregon Wine Blog, and we've been having fun debating screw caps versus cork enclosures, and you can check him out at theoregonwineblog.com or just become a friend of Clive's on Facebook. I so appreciate your being with us this week, and check out our podcasts on grapeencountersradio.com. Until next week, let's keep the glass half full.